看一下。All right, so the first question today is, okay, so dear Bhante, I have a problem with sleepiness. It is very comfortable and I seem to spend a lot of time sleeping in meditation. I know Ajahn Brahm says rest and get over it, but it becomes a habit. Any wise tips for getting over it or getting out of it? Okay, so then why is the mind prone to sleepiness? And there's a number of reasons for that. One of the basic reasons why it's prone to sleepiness is because it's tired, right? And that tiredness can be overcome by just resting, by waiting, and by sitting there. And eventually the mind will tend to brighten up. So that's one possibility here. The other possibility why the meditation is prone to sleepiness is because you haven't got enough energy in the mind. There isn't enough kind of oomph there, enough happiness, enough pleasure in the present moment. So because there isn't enough pleasure in the present, right here and right now, the mind tends to go off, right? It goes somewhere into a kind of pleasant abiding of sleepiness, which is preferred to being in the present moment. So you have to, what one has to do is try to find the happiness in the here and now, find the beauty in the here and now. And a lot of the things that I talk about, you hear Ajahn Brahm talking about this all the time, is to try to find the beauty in the present moment, right? Feel the peace in this place. It's very nice when you sit here. You know there's a large group of people sitting together, but the peace is tangible. You can feel the sense of peace. And the more you can feel that sense of peace, the more your mind inclines in that direction, right? And this is what all these recollections that we do are about, the recollections of one's virtuous conduct and all these kind of things, and one's good companions in the spiritual life. All of these things are about bringing that happiness into the present moment. That was what the very first sutta I was talking about was all about, this ability to showing you that the whole path of meditation is really about happiness. And unless you have that happiness there, it's not going to take off. So you have to bring that into your life somehow. You have to ask yourself, how can I generate that in the present moment? How can I, get into that sort of thing here? And of course, part of that is how we live our life in general, in daily life. Is there something I can do to improve that? Can I change my attitude? Can I be more positive towards my fellows in lay life or in monastic life or whatever? And then that, if you do that, that will bring up the happiness in the longer run in the meditation. And this is really the trick. This is where it all comes from. And this is what one has to kind of aim for in the long run. And there is no point in kind of using willpower to try to stay awake. You can do a bit of walking meditation sometimes, but the willpower is going to be counterproductive. In the long run, you have to just learn to use your mind in such a way that it brings out the joy, brings out the gladness. Wow! Beautiful, it's wonderful. You get this sense of elation inside. That's what it really comes back to in the end. And it's never going to work all the time. Sometimes the mind will not be in that mood and you will feel tired. But gradually you kind of move in that direction. Okay, so I hope that helps. Okay. Next one. Dear Ajahn, could you please explain a little bit more about yoniso manasikara? Is it clearly or deeply watch the thoughts which come to the mind? Thank you. Okay, so yoniso manasikara can probably be translated as something like wise attention. It has to be how we use our mind. We use our mind wisely or unwisely. The ayoniso manasikara is the kind of the unwise attention. So it's that wise attention. And basically, how you can define it is that if you use your mind wisely, what happens is that the good qualities in the mind increase and the bad one goes down. If the bad qualities increase and the good one go down, then you are using ayoniso manasikara, the unwise attention, right? So wise attention can be defined as that. Anything which leads in the right direction is yoniso manasikara. When Yono Semone Sikara is something that you require from the very beginning of the path, all the way to the very end. It's a very broad term which goes all the way along. So the moment you decide, okay, I'm going to, you know, start practicing a more spiritual life, I'm going to be more kind-hearted as a person, I'm going to practice meditation, all of those things, when you have an intention which leads you in the right direction, that is already Yoniso Manasikara. And every time you kind of get upset or angry or whatever because you're looking at the world in the wrong way, that is Ayoniso Manasikara. So watch your mind, and you will see that the defilements are coming. Okay, there must be some sort of Ayoniso Manasikara there, because the defilements are rising. Yeah. Every time you start to get into the right mood, you start to feel kind of very kind towards the people around you, the kindness comes naturally, you feel very good, everything feels right, you know that there is Yoniso Manasikara. Everything comes down to attention, how we attend, how we perceive. It's about how we look at things is the crucial issue. And because of that, you will see in the suttas, one of the things that the Buddha talks about a lot in the suttas is this thing called development of perception. We develop how we look at the world, how we perceive the world. And if you develop that in the right way, if you develop your perception in the right way, that is Yoniso Manasikara. So, you know, the Buddha talks about anicca sanya, the development of the perception of impermanence, right? So how do you do that? You remember that things are impermanent, whatever it is. You have the marana sanya, the recollection of death. You remind yourself that you're going to die. All of these ones are things that are Yoniso Manasikara when they work in the right way, that reduce the defilements. And the whole Buddhist path can be talked about just in terms of perception, developing perception in the right way. If you develop perceptions in the right way, it means you're attending to the world as it actually is, and your defilements start to decline. The whole path is about that. So it's all about how we use our mind, basically. Yoniso Manasikara. I hope that makes sense. If not, please come back with a second question and tell me my explanation is no good. You need some more explanation. Okay. Sometimes it's hard to know exactly what people are asking, so sometimes you have to kind of feel around a little bit. Communication is always rather imperfect in this world. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, I have found restraining a feeling of anger, for example, difficult for me because the feeling precedes the thought. By that time, the thought has had its way, so to speak. Okay, what is the best way to overcome this problem? The feeling arises first, right? That's a good sign, right? It means that you are aware of what's going on. You have some idea what's happening. There's a feeling there, and with that feeling, there's a perception, right? Why does that feeling arise in the first place? Because you are perceiving something in a certain way. So what is it? What is the perception that is the problem? And you will find out any kind of ill will, any kind of anger, the problem is always that you're focusing on the fault in something. You're focusing on the problem in something. You're seeing the negative aspect in somebody, right? That is the reason why these things are happening. And it's always that. So catch it early on. Look at what's going on. The feeling is there. What are you focusing on? What is the thing that gives rise to this feeling? And as soon as you see what that is, then you can change your attention to something else. Very often it's other people, right? Other people kind of irritate us and make us upset. This is just the nature of being close to people around us. So once another person irritates you, what is it? What are you focusing on in that person? And then just remind yourself of the other qualities. When you go out on the walking meditation path, if there is a particular person that tends to irritate you, just, you know, go through your mind all the good qualities in that person. Remind yourself of that again and again and again. And it is not that difficult to do, to change your perception in this way. And when you do that, then you sit down in meditation and you have built up this beautiful perception of this other person. As soon as a feeling arises, you shift your attention and you look at this other side instead. And when you look at the other side, the anger should disappear straight away. It's, It actually isn't that hard to do, but it takes a bit of training, right? Like everything in life, but it takes a bit of commitment and training. And this is a good opportunity to do it right here on this retreat. But it is actually a very powerful technique to get rid of these feelings of anger or thoughts of anger here. Okay, dear Ajahn, passive observing meditation means when something arises in our mind, we're just aware and totally silent. It means we don't need to say, let it be, or be kind to calm it. Can we apply passive observance in daily life? For example, when our family says something which is not good, we just do a passive observation. Thank you. The idea of passive observation is to basically to allow your mindfulness to become powerful, right? Basically to allow the mindfulness to become stronger. And initially, all you have to do is really just to allow things to calm down, to passively look at the thoughts, the sound, whatever is happening in your mind. And sometimes, of course, when defilements come into the mind, ideally, you have enough mindfulness already so you can actually change your attention. Listen, I was saying now about anger. You can change your attention. You look at the object in a different way. Or you change object. That's another way of doing it. So you have enough mindfulness to be able to do that. If you haven't got enough mindfulness, then just observe the anger. Just by observing it, you're taking a lot of power out of the defilement. The defilement is powerful because you're feeding it. If you're just observing, you're not actually feeding it anymore. You're just aware, and by not feeding it, it tends to calm down by itself, right? So these are two different ways of dealing with a defilement. One is just to keep observing it. Another one is actively to counteract it by changing your attention. And the most powerful of those techniques, by far, is to actively change your attention in a different place. That's by far the most powerful technique. But also, it takes more mindfulness, right? You have to be more aware. You have to have the ability to see what's going on and then shift your attention in the right way. And this is why that is. So you have to know what is the right technique at the right time. And this is part of the problem with this. Try the different things. See what works for you. You have to sort of find out for yourself what works with your level of mindfulness, etc. And then things you start to understand what you have to do. There is a nice sutta, which I haven't actually included in the suttas yet, that is called the Vitakka Santana Sutta. It's Majjhima Nikaya number 20, which you may want to read for yourself. And it talks about five ways of overcoming unwholesome thoughts. And the first way is called substitution, whereby straight away you see the bad thought, you substitute. And that is what I'm talking about. You change your perception. And you look at the other side of the object and you see the good things instead. Substitution. The most powerful one, right? Is first on the list. The second one is to remember the danger in that thought. So remember the danger in the thought. Remember, this is just going to lead to suffering. Why am I going down this way, right? This is crazy. Going to lead to problems and all kind of things. Okay, when you remember that, you move away. The third way is just not to pay any attention to that thought. You know, you're reading a sutta, you're quite happy, and suddenly this thought comes into your mind, which is no good. Okay, so you put your attention back on the page, and you don't really think about, try to forget about the thought. And the fourth way is just to be aware of the thought happening, and allowing it to die away, just by being very clearly aware of what is happening. This is just using awareness to allow it to die away. And the fifth method is to kind of suppress the thought by the power of the mind. I wouldn't recommend that. It can be sometimes it might be useful, but it's the last resort. So the most powerful one is to actually change your attention. So you have to find out what you want to use and what works for you at any particular time. So it means we don't need to say and just let it be and be kind and to calm it. Yes, it can mean that. It depends which technique you want to use. Can we apply passive observance in daily life? For example, when our family says something not good, just to passively observe. You can do that. It depends on your mind, right? If you feel that you are kind of, sometimes if you feel in a good mood and you know that and you know that the person is just being silly or stupid, you can just observe and you can just allow it to be, not to worry about it. Sometimes you can just remind, you know, help yourself a little bit with some wise thoughts, remind yourself that the person is just acting out their conditioning. They don't really want to be bad or anything like that. They're just acting out their conditioning from the past. And again, this is kind of reminding yourself that there isn't really any problem to be reactive to here. Or remind yourself that if you act in the wrong way, it's going to make the situation worse, going to create more suffering for yourself and the other person. So use this little skillful means to try to look at the situation differently, and then the problem usually passes that way. Okay, dear Ajahn, where is Bhikkhu Bodhi residing now? Can you tell his background? Tell of his background, thank you. Okay. So Bhikkhu Bodhi, he is residing in a monastery close to New York, which is called the something like the Chuang Yen Monastery or something like that. It's a Chinese monastery. So it's a Chinese name, Chuang Yen. It's about an hour's drive north of New York, apparently. I've never been there. And that's where he's staying. And his background is that he's from New York. And he has a PhD in philosophy, studied at in California, I think. And then he became a monk shortly after that in his late 20s. And then eventually he went to Sri Lanka, and he was the president of the Buddhist Publication Society in Sri Lanka for a number of years. And he wrote quite a lot in those days. And he's written quite a prolific translator. Some of the best translations from Pali into English are done by Bhikkhu Bodhi. You know, he has translated basically the Majjhima Nikaya, the Sanghita Nikaya, the Anguttara Nikaya, three of the four most important works in the Pali he has translated. In addition to that, he has translated other stuff, and he's very reliable. I have worked quite a bit with him myself, and he's a very careful scholar, right? He takes a long time to do his translations. The Sanghita Nikaya took about 10 years to translate, and Anguttara probably a little bit shorter. But he's very meticulous, very careful. And when I kind of argue with him about how certain things should be translated, he's very patient, and he listens to what you have to say. Even though I'm just a whippersnapper compared to him, he's been a monk for 40 years, he listens to you, right? He takes what you say seriously. That's very nice when somebody who is more senior and more learned than you are take you seriously. It feels very good. So you have a sense of integrity when you're communicating with Bhikkhu Bodhi. It's too easy to kind of dismiss someone who has less experience than you have, but he never does that. And that's very, it's a very good thing. I would say, if you want to read any translations into English of the Pali, his translations are, in my opinion, the best ones. Okay, dear Ajahn, I have a serious commitment to the path, okay? I'm trying to live a celibate life as I can clearly see the danger in relationships, etc., to the path. However, lust has come into my mind. This is a great concern and worry for me. Okay. It is not possible to avoid meeting this person who is the cause for the arising of lust as I work with them and need to interact with them. I have been reflecting on the enormous hindrance this could bring to the progress of my path if I follow my lust. I have also been reflecting things that are not so attractive or good about this person. Then this lust subsides temporarily, but when I am with them, lust comes back. Please help. Okay. The path to enlightenment is too important to me. So how to deal with this kind of thing. I'm going to talk a lot about later on how to deal with sensuality and the sensual realm. And it is not easy, because these things are very deep-rooted things. And the Buddha says that sensuality, and of course lust is part of sensuality, these things fade very slowly. It takes quite a long time to overcome them. But Still, there are some kind of basic things to remember that you can use to overcome these things. And one of them is just to remind yourself of the danger in that. If you say here that you can already see the danger in relationship, lust tends to lead to relationships, right? So if you can see the danger in relationships and how that kind of drags you away from the path, how you lose your clarity, how you get trapped in a certain way, you lose your freedom, you lose your ability just to go to a kuti in the forest and just relax and be away. That is already, you can already kind of distance yourself quite a bit by doing it, following that kind of idea, seeing the danger in this, seeing how it is going to bound to lead to suffering in the future. I sometimes think back, you know, if something similar ever happens to me, I just think back to some of the relationships I had before I was a monk. It's getting a long time ago now, but I don't really want to be in those relationships again. And I know that if I follow that thought, I know that's where it eventually leads, right? And then it makes the thought kind of unpleasant when you know that it leads to somewhere you don't want to be. Then kind of the whole thought becomes almost unpleasant. So the mind tends to move away in a different direction. Sometimes that works. Sometimes it doesn't. I know that some of the ways of thinking about this, of course, is the kind of the Buddha's way of thinking about this. And that is, there's a number of things that are mentioned in the suttas, how the Buddha talks about these things. And of course, seeing the non-attractive part of this person is part of that, right? One of the things to remember always is that the person, if somebody is attractive to you, remember that that attraction is impermanent. This person may be very attractive to you now, they may be very beautiful, but remember that they're going to get old, right? This is going to last only a few years. And before you know it, you know, the body starts to fall apart, your body starts to fall apart, their body starts to fall apart. So imagine this person, what they're going to be like when they are 70 or 80 years old. Would you fall in love with them if they were 70 or 80 years old? Probably not. And we all look roughly the same when we get to that age, right? There isn't that much difference. So remember that. So you're actually, what you are getting involved with is actually, you're getting involved with that old age right away. Because old age is part of our body as it is right now. Even if you're young, it's already part of you because it's bound to happen sooner or later. So you're actually marrying that person, getting involved with that person who already is bound to become old at some stage. So that is quite a useful reflection. One of the great ways that I remember coming to mind now, when the Buddha was talking about desire and sensuality in particular, and relationships, he talks about how relationships come to be. And one of the interesting things, often we think that, you know, attraction to the opposite gender comes about because you are seeing the beauty in the other person. And of course, there is some aspect, there's some truth to that. But what the Buddha said, that attraction to the opposite gender, it comes first of all because you are focusing on yourself. You know, if you go around thinking, yeah, I'm a man, you know, and I walk in this way and I talk in this way and I do things in a kind of manly way, and you focus on your masculinity, you focus on those things which make you kind of, you know, make you think that you are masculine. Or as a woman, you focus on your feminine aspects. You think, I do things in this way because I'm a woman and I'm charming in this way, and whatever it is. If we focus on those things that make that gender identity in ourselves, that is the initial stage of actually being attracted to the opposite gender. It's very fascinating. So the more you think of yourself as being a particular gender, the more you identify with your own gender, the more you are attracted also to the opposite gender. It's a very powerful teaching. So instead of focusing on yourself as a gender, you actually just think of yourself as a person. You don't kind of reflect on yourself as a gender at all. You're just a person, right? It doesn't matter what gender you are. And you forget about that. And then the attraction to the opposite gender also fades away. And this is the danger. You know, if you like to go to the gym, if you are a man, you like to go to the gym to kind of, you know, build up your muscles and all this kind of stuff. If you do that, of course, you're focusing on your idea of masculinity. It isn't what it is like to be a man. And when you do that, that is bound to give rise to desire for the opposite gender. And this is the problem. So anything we do, we focus on these things. That is where the problem often originates. So what you have to do is just be human, just be a person. Don't focus on these things. Don't think about yourself at all in terms of gender. You just are a person, that's all. And then you're heading in the right direction. Another way which the Buddha, this is a thing that's coming to mind as I'm going along here. So another thing that the Buddha says about overcoming this problem is that he says that we should look upon the person of, you know, he says to the monks, look upon a woman, if she is younger than you, as your daughter, if she's the same age as your sister, and if she's older than you, as your mother, right? So have that relationship with women. They are your daughter, your sister, or your mother. And once you think of them like that, it changes your perception, right? You think of the opposite, and for women, you think about someone as your son, your brother, or your father. And that changes, again, straight away, your relationship with that person. You have a different view about them. It's more of a caring kind of relationship instead of a sensual one. Okay, anyway, there are some hints, and I will talk more about this later on. Okay, dear Ajahn, you said I started using I started using the natural method, but my mind is running to the far end. Okay, using the willpower is a little bit working. Shall I use the willpower to stop the willpower? Please explain. Okay, so this is the problem. Life becomes very complicated after a while because you're seeing the willpower. How can you stop this willpower? So you use willpower to stop it, and then you use more willpower to stop that willpower, and it goes on like that forever, right? You can see how you can get yourself into serious trouble that way, and eventually you go completely bananas because you're just getting really messed up in your mind. So no, don't use willpower to stop the willpower. If you see the willpower in the mind, what you have to do, just allow the willpower to be, right? Allow anything to be, anything which is there, just allow it to be. And if you just allow the willpower to be, you're actually undermining that willpower, right? That is the very nature of allowing things to be, is that you're undermining the willpower. And this is what I said during the meditation, it's about accepting things. Whatever is going on, you just accept it as it is. If you accept willpower as it is, it's not really willpower anymore. It starts to die down, it starts to disappear. So the willpower cannot coexist with acceptance. Acceptance is the opposite. So don't use willpower, just observe. Watch the willpower in your mind. What is going on? And as you do that, the thing starts to die down. Everything that we observe in our mind as we do meditation practice, all the disturbances, all the thoughts, everything that comes in, all of it is due to the will. All of it is due to intention. All of it is created by ourselves, right? Every thought you have made that. Sometimes it's a bit scary. Did I really create this thought? No, poor, that's terrible. I don't really want to be the owner of this thought. But yes, we do because of all the conditions from the past. So you just have to relax. You just allow things to be. You don't do anything. And you're taking the power out of that thinking mind. So allow your mind to run a little bit. If your mind is running too much and you feel kind of terrible, you're feeling restless and you're not enjoying it at all, then use that running mind to maybe just direct it a little bit. Do a bit of metta meditation, right? Try to use some of the techniques of metta which I'm talking about. Just see that, you know, the goodness in some of the people that you know, the people around you, whatever it is. And just by focusing on that goodness, try to get a little bit of good feeling arising. It doesn't have to be much good feeling, just a little bit. And when the good feeling arises, that's another way that undermines the mind, which is restless and agitated and runs around. Do a bit of walking meditation. You know, walk back and forth just at your natural pace. And in the beginning, that might be quite fast. And then as you calm down, it becomes slower, right? So do a bit of walking meditation. Go for a walk in the bush. Just enjoy the peace. That's another nice trick, is just to allow you know, whenever kind of you have a glimpse and a feeling of the peace, feel that. What does it feel like? What does peace feel like? And you find it's such a beautiful thing, right? When you become a little bit peaceful, a tiny bit of peace is such a wonderful thing. And once you start to appreciate that, the mind inclines a little bit more in that direction. But this is a long-term problem. You cannot, you know, overcoming the kind of the active mind is something which doesn't happen in a kind of just like that. On a retreat like this, you will see that some days your mind is very, very active. On other days, it's more peaceful. It changes all the time. And that's okay. Just notice that. And then gradually, you can move yourself in the right direction. Why is it that on some days the mind is more peaceful? Try to look into that. See the causality. See how things work. And this is what the Buddha is talking about in the Satipatthana Sutta. Understanding the causality of the defilements. Why they are there. Why they are not there. And then you can move away. Okay. Okay, Ajahn Brahmali, you mentioned that we should look at karma from intention and motive. Do researchers or research scientists make unwholesome karma when they use mice for their experiments? The motive seems like to find better drugs or better ways to treat a disease. Would appreciate your comment. Thank you. Okay, so this is an important question, right? What happens if you are kind of using these things for research and you're trying to find a good drug for somebody? And the point there is that, you know, if you kill an animal just for the pleasure because you like killing it, then obviously it's very bad, it's very serious because you are really deluded and you don't understand anything about the problem that you're creating here. If you kill an animal because you have compassion for people, you want to help create a drug, you'd rather not kill the animal. But in certain cases, it might be unavoidable, right? And you do it with that kind of understanding. You'd rather not do it, but you do it for something else. It is much less bad karma. So again, it's about degrees of bad karma. Still, there's probably a little bit bad karma there, right? Because you're still killing the mouse, and you still have the intention to kill it, even though the bigger picture is good. There's still that little bit of intention there, right there and then, when you're killing it. So ideally, you want to get away from that as well. But you can see that in that situation, it is far less, the bad karma is far less. And it's probably more like grey karma, right? It might get you reborn as a human being again. It may not take you to the heavenly realms, but maybe it will take you back to a human being. But it all depends on how you do it. Other research scientists, they may just be interested in the fame, right? They may be doing it for the prestige, to be able to write good articles in famous journals and become famous and create a good drug. There are so many, even being a research scientist can vary enormously what your motivation is, from compassion to kind of greed for promotion and for all kinds of things. So again, you have to look into the mind of the research scientist to know what is going on. Only you can know your intention and your motivation. So that is the crucial thing which decides the karma behind these things. But of course, ideally, we try to avoid these things. And ideally, a research scientist too should do their very best to avoid these things, if at all possible. And if it is impossible, well then you should still know that what you're doing is not ideal. And then you are minimizing the bad effects. Okay, dear Ajahn, how to cope with fear of death when you are not well? Thank you. Okay, so fear of death. Well, sometimes I have been to Ajahn Brahm, I've been to hospital with Ajahn Brahm when somebody is dying, right? They're really out of it. They're on their very last legs. They have some very severe cancer. You can see that they're only days away before they're going to die here. And I'm always amazed at how Ajahn Brahm kind of tackles these things. You know, Ajahn Brahm, he would say to the person, great, you know, now you're finally getting out of this miserable body. You're going to move on. It's going to be a wonderful experience for you. You know, to die is going to be great. You leave the body behind and you go off and you're kind of happy leaving it behind, right? He's so positive about this. And this is, In the most of society, we'll say, oh, you're dying, that's terrible. Adam Brahm is the exact opposite. And it's kind of, it's very refreshing when you hear that. And so usually, the death experience, if you are a good person, and if your general behavior is good, you haven't got that much to fear, right? Because the karma, the good things you have done in the life, they will kind of carry you forward in a good way. So remember that death in Buddhism, death is actually not such a big deal. Death is not the problem. The problem is how we live our lives. That is the problem. Death is just like a transition, right? You're going from one life and then you're moving on to the next one. It's a bit like moving houses or something, changing bodies or whatever. It's not such a big deal. It's how we live that really matters. And so focus on that. So when you, if you find that you have a fear of death and you're afraid of this, this is a good opportunity to reflect also on how you live your life. Why is it that you have that fear? How can you improve your life? How can you change things so that you can actually live even better for the future? And this will probably, perhaps, help you to overcome that fear a little bit. It is actually very one of the things about not being well and seeing that fear of death is also that it is a good opportunity to contemplate death, right? If you are close to dying, and this is a chance to say something about your life. Again, why is that fear there? The fear is there because you're attached to something. You're holding on to something. There is a problem there. So this is an opportunity to resolve something. So try to understand the fear. Once you understand where the fear comes from, why it is there, then you have a chance to find a solution to the problem. So what are you afraid of? Is it because you're going to lose everything around you? Then there is a sense of attachment there, right? How can you deal with that attachment? You can deal with it by, in many ways, one of the ways is simply to understand that sooner or later you're going to have to give up all these things anyway. You can deal with it by doing something more in your Buddhist practice to reduce your dependency on happiness externally. So it's a gradual thing, but this is always, and every time there's a problem in life, every time there is a fear, every time there is something which is difficult, there is an opportunity to learn. And this is the ideal way to deal with any problem. Deal with it by trying to learn, instead of by becoming kind of overburdened by the negativity or the hardship that is coming your way. And there's always difficulties, right? Even if you're a monk, there's always difficulties. There's always problems to be resolved. But use them skillfully, and then they become very powerful tools for moving forward. It's like the Ajahn Brahm's idea of the truckload of dung, right? So this is, the fear of death is a bit of dung for you to kind of to move forward and do something better in your life. Okay. Dear Ajahn, when one has a habitual bad slouch or bad posture during meditation, that would be the most comfortable posture. Should one mindfully exert will to sit better or more upright? Thank you. You don't have to. If you have a natural slouch or bad posture, then it doesn't really matter so much. You know, what you can do, you can also sit against the wall, right? Or you can sit against a chair. If you feel the posture is too bad, you can lean against something. It doesn't really matter. Don't exert too much willpower. This is the thing, you know, it says in the Anapanasati Sutta, it says that you sit down, you cross, put your legs crosswise, and then you put your body in an erect position, right? That's what it says in the Satipatthana Sutta, in the Anapanasati Sutta. So that is the ideal posture for meditation. But remember that the person that is talked about there is someone who already has established mindfulness, right? Mindfulness is already strong. And when mindfulness is strong, it is quite natural to sit in that posture. But if mindfulness is not strong, then sometimes by forcing yourself into an unnatural posture, it makes you tense. You can't really relax 100%. And if you can't relax 100%, your meditation is not likely to work all that well. So see what happens. If you can sit in a straight posture and still be relaxed, it's fine. If you can't, then don't do it, because it will be counterproductive. Then instead, sit against the wall, lean against the wall, sit on a chair, or even just, you know, have a slightly slouching posture if that works for you. It is okay. You don't have to have a perfect posture. It's not about what you look like to the others. It's just about what works for you that really matters. Okay. Dear Ajahn, at Majjhima Nikaya 123, is it true that the Buddha's mother gave birth while standing? Okay. And Buddha straight away can walk 7 steps and talk. Okay, so this is called the Acharya Abuddha Sutta, which means Acharya Abuddha means like wonderful and marvelous. And the reason for that is because when you read that sutta, the few things in there are quite wonderful and marvelous. And that's why it's called the Wonderful and Marvelous Sutta. And this is all about the things, the wonders and marvels that happened with the person, the Bodhisattva, if you like, the Buddha to be. Just before he came into his last life and also afterwards. And this particular sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 123, also exists in Chinese translation, so it's possible to compare the Pali with the Chinese. And some of the things that you find in this sutta is that it actually is quite different in the Chinese than it is in the Pali. Each sutta has a lot of additional things which the other ones doesn't have. Sometimes the suttas are incredibly close, even though they've been apart for such a long time. But in this case, there's quite a lot of differences. This is a type of sutta which is what we would call hagiographical. Hagiography is like the kind of the praising of the saints, right? It's kind of the Christian term, which means that you write these stories about the saints, and you write them to sound very, to glorify them in a sense. And this is kind of the hagiography of the Buddha to be before he became the Buddha. And this is usually a sign of lateness in the suttas. And the reason, and there's a very interesting book, which is called the Origin of the Bodhisattva Ideal, or something like that, written by a monk called Bhikkhu Anālaya, who was one of the leading scholars in this particular field. And he shows you how the Bodhisattva Ideal gradually came out after the Buddha passed away. And what is probably going on there, you can imagine having the Buddha around you, right? The Buddha, obviously, a very powerful person. Has incredibly powerful spiritual qualities, very peaceful, very kind, has all these things, right? And imagine losing somebody like that. Imagine the shock to the Buddhist community, the one who started this whole thing, the one who carried Buddhism forward for so long. Suddenly he passes away, he's no longer there. What does that mean? It means a vacuum, right? It means a sense of loss, a sense of absence. I remember some of the monks who were around at Ajahn Chah's time, they said when he died, they felt the same way. It was like this vacuum suddenly. The big leader, the big spiritual person who was there, has passed away and gone. And now we are left with nothing. The teacher has disappeared. And there's a sense of feeling lost in a way, because you don't know what you're supposed to do. You don't have anyone to go to anymore. And this shows you the danger of relying on somebody too much, right? And shows the importance of having a sense of independence on the spiritual path. But of course, if somebody, a figure of such stature as the Buddha, when somebody like that passes away, it is bound to have some sort of effect on you. And one of the effects is that when that happens, people start to think back, actually, who was the Buddha? How much do we actually know about him anyway? And then they start writing the life stories, and they start to write about all these things because they want to remember him. The loss is too great, right? And this is how you get the beginning of this kind of literature seems to come about, because of that sense of loss. And this particular sutta is probably a very early example of that sort of literature coming into existence. And there is, as I said before, there is good evidence that this sutta is from a slightly later time than the time of the Buddha himself. So that is basically what. What does all this mean? It means that we are allowed to take this kind of literature. You are allowed to take it with a pinch of salt. You don't have to sort of say, okay, because of faith, I have to believe in this. No, you don't have to do that. You have to be wise about these things. There is the word of the Buddha, and there is later things that have come afterwards. And this is very likely to be one of those later things. It's important to be to use this sort of investigative literary criticism, they often call this, whereby you look at the literature with kind of rational eyes to see what is the real message and what is later things. So is it true that Buddha's mother gave birth standing up? It sounds very strange, doesn't it? I don't know if it's possible to give birth standing up. I never ever heard of anybody doing that before. It sounds really, really strange. I don't know how that could actually happen. So I would say probably not. That's what I would say. And the Buddha straight away can walk 7 steps and talk. Again, it sounds extremely, very hard to believe that these things can happen. Sometimes you hear of strange stories, right? I remember Ajahn Brahm told this famous, I don't know where he got this from, but he said that there was a newspaper article in the US. This was a few years ago. And this was an article about this baby who had just been born. And then as soon as it had been born, it opened its mouth and it said, "Oh no, not again," right? So maybe this was a Buddhist in a past life, and then it realized it was done a big mistake by coming back again. But again, those newspaper stories, those two I take with a pinch of salt. So you have there are some problems there. We have to be rational in this, in our practice of Buddhism. We can't kind of do things which we can't believe in everything just because it is in certain books. So it's good to be rational about these things. It's actually quite hard sometimes to find an exact dividing line between what we is reasonable to believe in and what is not reasonable to believe in. Sometimes it's quite hard. It takes quite a bit of discernment to be able to do that. There are certain things that we think perhaps we shouldn't believe in, which actually probably we should, right? So sometimes we get it wrong. So this is quite a difficult thing. But anyway, okay, next one. Dear Ajahn, could you please explain why the allowable foods after noon are cheese, chocolate, ginger, sweets in particular? Thank you. Is that what everybody's getting here? Okay. So the thing here is that it's important not to get too hung up in these kind of issues, because these are very minor things, right? And sometimes in Buddhism we get into these discussions about tiny little things as if they are the most important part of the Buddhist path. Actually, they're probably utterly irrelevant. So why are these allowable? Okay, the reason these things are allowable is because at the time of the Buddha, there were people who were ill, and then in the evening or in the afternoon they needed some kind of sustenance to keep them going, right? And the Buddha said, well, there are these things which are allowable, which I will allow you to have in the evening. That was oil, sugar, honey, ghee, and something called Navanitang. Navanitang was the last one of these 5, right? So these 5 things. And Navanitang, nobody knows exactly what it is. Some people say it's cheese, some people say it's butter. Actually, it's probably none of those things. It's something which nobody knows. It was made in India 2,500 years ago, and it's very obscure. So what do you do then? Well, you say, okay, if somebody says it's cheese, good enough. If somebody else says it's butter, good enough, right? We don't need to argue about these tiny little things. It is so utterly irrelevant. We have to focus on what really matters on the Buddhist path. So that is why you have cheese in the evening. Sweets, again, because sweets are basically sugar, right? So sugar is allowable. There are also certain lifetime medicines. Lifetime medicines are things like, according to the Vinaya again, things like cocoa, coffee, tea, and many other things are allowable as lifetime medicine for monastics. So chocolate is made of cocoa, which is a lifetime medicine. It's made of oils and fats and sugar, which are also allowable in the evening. So that's why how chocolate comes to be allowable, right? So there's an explanation for all of these things. And ginger is a medicinal type of fruit. It's not the kind of fruit or a root, actually, isn't it? Ginger is a root, isn't it? So it is a medicinal type of root, and as a medicinal type of root, that too is allowed by the Buddha. So that is how it comes out. That's why these things are allowable in the afternoon. There's many other things which are can also be considered allowable, which comes under non-edible fruits and all these kind of things, lifetime medicines and what have you. So it's a bit random. Cheese is quite sustaining, right? It's a bit. It's very different from things like chocolate and sweets. But anyway, there you are. Okay, what leads to Nibbana? The Eightfold Path or the gradual training, right? So you reckon there is a distinction here between the two. So Eightfold Path is more equal and reasonable. Gradual training starts when needing to shave your head and put on the robe. It sounds a bit like the caste system, okay? Seems more right. Comment, please. Okay. What leads to Nibbana? The Eightfold Path. Both lead to Nibbana, right? They're not just different things. They are the same thing. Both of these things are... This is one of the points I'm trying to make during these talks, is that you can see the Eightfold Path structure. You can see that in the gradual training. Each element of the Noble Eightfold Path is there in the gradual training. So these are the same things. The reason why the gradual training starts with shaving the head and becoming a monastic is because it goes all the way to awakening. And somewhere along that path, you will become a monastic. At the very latest, you become a monastic at the moment you actually reach awakening. But far the majority of cases, you become a monastic long before that. Why, you know, if you are a stream entry, if you've seen the Dhamma, if you know where happiness lies, why on earth do you want to live lay life? You don't want to live lay life anymore. It doesn't make any sense. You understand where happiness lies. Happiness lies in renouncing all those things. If you're not interested in relationships, if you're not interested in worldly things, why would you want to live lay life? If you can live the monastic life, which is focused, you know, 100%, not 100%, but a lot more on the spiritual practice and on doing all the spiritual things, why wouldn't you want to be there instead? It doesn't make any sense to live the lay life anymore. And that's why you tend to gravitate. The more profound your insight, the more profound your meditation, the deeper your wisdom and understanding, the more you gravitate towards the... monastic life. This is just natural. But it doesn't mean that the gradual training, it doesn't mean that you have to start with shaving your head at the very beginning. That can happen anyway through this training, right? That's basically what it means. Just like the Eightfold Path, becoming a monastic can happen anywhere really along that Noble Eightfold Path. Often it happens after you had a deep meditation, because then you realize, wow, there's something here which is very important. Once you have an experience of deep meditation, it means you understand what renouncing the world of the senses and the renouncing the world really is about. Now you understand, of course, I must renounce this world. Now I understand where happiness really lies. Right? So why would you not become a monastic? It's the only sensible thing to do. If you understand that that's where happiness is, why wouldn't you do it? So the problem is that we don't really see and understand where happiness lies, and that's why we don't do the renouncing and become monastics. It doesn't mean that all monastics necessarily understand it either. It's just that, you know, sometimes you're just inclined that way for all kinds of reasons. So it's a caste system. It's not really a caste system. Everybody is practicing the same way, right? It's just a lay person practices and monastic practices. We just practice. We try to work together. And if we work together and we support each other, it becomes very powerful. Okay. Dear Adam, your teaching is excellent. Could you please give us a small background of yourself? And how is and when and why you became a monk? Okay. Why I became a monk? Well, it just seemed like a good idea, right? I thought, okay, maybe I should become a monk. So I tried it out, I checked it out, and after I sort of started the monastic life, I realized actually this is a really good idea. So I became even more interested. But I think really what happened is that, as I remember in my early years, when I went to university, I was studying engineering at university, and they had this exchange program. You could kind of travel to some country abroad, and I wanted to go to Asia. So there was a chance to go to Japan, and I went to Japan in my early 20s. This is getting close to 30 years ago now. When I went to Japan, I read my first book on Buddhism, and I went to all these monasteries, and I saw all these Buddha statues, right? And you kind of feel a sense of familiarity, the sense of interest in these things. Well, why is that interest there? It's very fascinating for me to understand why is the interest there. I didn't have any Buddhist friends. My family wasn't Buddhist. I didn't know anybody from Asia. In those days, in Norway, there wasn't many immigrants of any sort, you know, let alone from far away in Asia. So I didn't really have any kind of contact with that sort of people. And yet, there was this kind of desire to do this. Where does that come from? And later on, I have to admit, I think it is very likely that it comes from, to me, the only explanation is really, maybe not the only one, but the most rational one to me seems to be it must come from some kind of past life. Why otherwise would I want to do all these things? And then when I got back after that particular trip to Asia, one of my best friends, he said, here, you must read this book. And that book was called The Calm Technique. And it was a meditation method on meditating on the breath, right? That kind of just comes your way. Suddenly just, you know, how do these books just suddenly land in your lap? One of your friends just brings it to you and gives it to you. And then I tried that. And I had some nice results from just watching, doing the breath meditation. I was a student at the time. I was able to find a bit of space and time for myself. And I had some good results. And later on, that always came back to me, these good results in meditation practice. And that is what ultimately led me to check out monastic life, because I wanted to pursue that happiness. Later on, I went to study finance. And study finance, that was a very bad idea, because it wasn't really the sort of thing that really interested me at all. And I did it more because it sounded like it kind of, maybe it would kind of boost my chances of getting a good job or whatever, but it wasn't a very good idea, and I didn't really like the environment or anything like that. And that's when I realized, actually, what I should do instead is to try to find somewhere to meditate. Let's check out these monasteries. And that's really how it all started. And then from there, eventually, I ended up here. That was in England, in the UK in those days. Then eventually, I heard a talk by Ajahn Brahm, and it's very strange, but I knew straight away, this is my teacher. And I came to Australia because I knew Ajahn Brahm was my teacher. And that has, of course, been the case for the last 20 years. I've been here ever since. So that was the right call at that time. No doubt about that. Anyways, that is a little bit about myself. I'm glad that you enjoy the teaching. It's always good to hear that. If I sit up here and everybody thinks it's terrible, it feels a bit like I'm wasting my time. So it's always good to hear that. Okay. So, dear Ajahn, is there a particular book you would recommend for me to read that elaborates and expands on the 8 precepts in a clear, easily understandable way, so I could further explore this after returning home after the retreat? Thank you. A book that talks about the 8 precepts. Maybe what you can do is a search online, right? Type in 8 precepts and see what comes up. I'm sure you get lots of hits just by searching that one. And then try to find some reliable guide, someone you recognize who has written that particular, whatever it is. Or you can get a book like Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation called In the Buddha's Words. I think that has a suttas in there which talk about the 8 precepts as well. I think so, because the 8 precepts are actually in the suttas and they are explained in there. They're actually very beautifully explained in there, very powerfully. The Buddha talks about the 8 precepts, and he says in there, he says that this is how you should think. Just like the arahant, right? The arahant, the fully awakened ones, just like the arahant keep the first precept all the life, not to kill any living being, so I too will keep this precept for this day and night. So this is when you do the Upasana observance, the full moon observance, right? Like you're doing here. Just like the arahant keeps this for the whole life, so I will keep this for these 9 days.
Isn't that inspiring? This is what people do automatically if they are fully pure, fully purified. This is the natural expression of their purity, that they keep these precepts. Right? Just like the Arahant never lies, right? Just like the Arahant never steals. Just like the Arahant never adorns themselves or listens to entertainment. Just like the Arahant never eats in the afternoon. So too, I will do this. Just like the Arahant. You're moving into the realm of the Arahant, right? That's what you're doing here. Isn't that kind of inspiring? These are the perfectly pure people with so much kindness, so much goodness, so much peace inside, always compassionate, and you're moving into that realm. It's a wonderful thought, isn't it? And this is the kind of the way you need to inspire yourself. And if you inspire yourself in this way, that's when the meditation begins to take off. So you need to think in these ways. And this is the beauty sometimes of reading these suttas. Sometimes you come across passages like that and you think, wow, that's so inspiring. That means, you know, I'll bring this into my practice and allow myself to feel the beauty and the joy of that particular thing here. So read that. And if you have problems, if you cannot find this sutta, then please ask me. You're allowed to ask me at any time. You can ask me on the forum. There is a Buddhist Society forum on the internet. You can ask there. You can meet, come to the monastery and ask me, or you can do whatever. You're more than welcome to ask me in person. To do this, or you can come over at the interview time. If there isn't enough interview space, Bianca, maybe we can just add a little bit, you know, extra. I'm happy to do another. It's only every other day. I'm happy to do a little bit extra on those days if necessary. Yeah. Okay. So the last question for today: Dear Ajahn, in daily life, sexual misconduct is included. Includes more than one wife, husband, and boyfriend or girlfriend. Does it include this? I would say yes. It does include that. This is not entirely clear from the way it is described in the suttas. But the problem is, remember that the idea behind these precepts is that we don't want to hurt other people, right? So if you have a relationship with somebody who's not your partner, it's very, very likely that you will hurt that partner. And for that reason, it's called sexual misconduct, because you're hurting somebody else. What we want to do on the spiritual path is make other people happy. We want to support other people. We want to do what's good for them. We don't want to create a miserable life for them. So this is why this is considered misconduct. So any kind of misconduct which hurts somebody else, that is what is considered sexual misconduct. And this is why, from a Buddhist point of view, to be gay is not necessarily bad, right? Because you're not really hurting anyone just by being gay. It's not wrong in Buddhism. And this is also why there may be circumstances where you have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and there may perhaps be circumstances where it's not wrong to also have another partner, depending on what kind of relationship you have. There's no absolute thing there. The question is always, are they being hurt or are they not being hurt? That is the question that it comes back to. And of course, there are many types of sexual misconduct which is very, very obviously is misconduct, where obviously you are hurting others, taking advantage and all these kind of things, which obviously is very, very bad. And I don't think I have to spell it out. I think it's very obvious what those things are. But again, it comes back to whether you are hurting someone else. That is basically the bottom line there. Okay, so that is the questions for this evening. And so I will see you again tomorrow morning. So enjoy your night and keep on practicing. Have a good time.